That's the end of the first half. As the teams head to the locker room, the Spartans lead the Bulldogs by a score.
You guys stink.
Jeez, Coach, we're only down a couple of points.
No, I mean you guys really smell. You need to hit the showers. And here, I got every one of you new bars of soap from the Sterling Soap Company. Each bar is artisan crafted using natural ingredients and essential oils. They also have shave soaps, colognes, beard balm, and a whole lot more. Now get in there.
But Coach, we have another half to play.
I don't care. I can't stand to be around you.
A few minutes later.
All right, bring it in tight. You guys are still playing terrible, but you're smelling great out there. Now listen, you're going to need to stock up for the rest of the season. We got a lot of tough games left. So go to sterlingsoap.com after the game. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com. You got that?
Yes, Coach.
Great. sterlingsoap.com on three. One, two, three.
sterlingsoap.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, old sports, and welcome to another episode of the Hello, Old Sports podcast on the Sports History Network. This is Dan Newman, and I'm joined, as always, by my brother and co-host, Andrew. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right, Dan. I could try to make a tenuous connection between it's St. Patrick's Day and what we're recording is vaguely connected to something Irish, although, you know, but I'll skip that.
So I actually do have a little bit of a connection there, and I hope our guest, who I'll introduce in a second, will indulge us because I think he might appreciate this too. As those of you who listen know, Andrew and I are both born and raised New Yorkers and New York sports fans, but my wife is a Boston sports fan, grew up in the Boston area. So our son, our 3-year-old, has clothes, you know, from each of the teams, New York, Boston, and we're kind of trying to influence him. And so today for St. Patrick's Day, he had on his Larry Bird t-shirt, and he insists most nights on FaceTiming with his grandparents, with my parents. And so just a few minutes ago, he's eating dinner and he's eating his, he's got his Larry Bird shirt on. And my father, he notices, he's, oh, you got your Larry Bird shirt on. And then he says to me, he goes, hey, speaking of Larry Bird, I ordered this really cool book and it's supposed to arrive tomorrow. It's called Heartland. And so I said to him, I said, well, Dad, it's funny you mentioned that, because in about 20 minutes on the podcast, Andrew and I are interviewing the author of that book. And so shall we say no more? Our guest is the author, Keith O'Brien. He's the author of a number of great books, including a great great Pete Rose book from a couple years ago called Charlie Hustle. But tonight we are here to talk about Heartland, A Forgotten Place, An Impossible Dream, and The Miracle of Larry Bird. And Keith, thanks so much for joining us here tonight.
I love any introduction that includes both a father and a grandson in a Larry Bird t-shirt. That is amazing.
Well, if it was my druthers, it would probably be a Patrick Ewing t-shirt or a Clyde Frazier t-shirt. But my wife won out for St. Patrick's Day.
That's not appropriate for St. Patrick's
exactly,
Day.
Exactly.
That's a different day.
Exactly. Well, so we were talking just a minute before we started recording, and this is, and I say this without hyperbole, one of the best sports books that I've read in a long time. I basically got through the whole thing in a day and a half. Maybe tell us a little bit about the story you're telling in this book and what made you want to tell this story.
So Heartland is an origin story. This narrative unfolds between 1973 and 1979. It unfolds almost exclusively in rural Indiana. Everything after that is effectively epilogue material for me. It is the story of the rise of Larry Bird in rural Indiana, and really the story of the enduring miracle of his 1979 Indiana State team. It began with a simple premise. You know, I feel like for the last 50 years, we've been telling this story one way. We always do the Bird magic thing. You know, we weave together the stories of Larry Bird and Magic Johnson. And as a sports fan, I get why we do that, of course. You know, Bird and Magic are going to play each other in that epic championship game, March 1979, the most watched college basketball game of all time. And then they're going to save the NBA, change everything, become icons. I get it. But the reality is, in the 1970s, Bird and Magic barely know each other. They've met one time. In that one time, they hardly spoke. So, you know, Magic Johnson really to Larry is no different than Sidney Moncrief or Mark Aguirre, other stars that he also plays that spring. And so, you know, what I really wanted to do is just sort of tilt the camera in a slightly different direction, change the perspective just a little, zoom in on this origin story. And when you do that, what you get is almost a completely different story. And you certainly get an entirely different cast of characters. These are a group of, you know, scrappy underdogs just like Bird, a lot of them from rural Indiana, who are going to save Larry, frankly, and deliver us Larry Bird, you know, and without them, without this cast of characters that populates this narrative, I think there's a chance we never know Larry Bird's name. We never know of him at all.
And it's interesting because, you know, there's been obviously a million documentaries, shows, books, whatever, written, told about the Bird Magic story. And this is always the first chapter is, oh, and then they played in the national championship game. And here's a bunch of other stuff that happened. And if you kind of aren't, if you're familiar with the story, you almost take this for granted. But something, if you sort of come into it fresh, you go, okay, so Magic's Michigan State team against Bird's Indiana State team. Wait a second. How did Larry Bird get Indiana State to the national championship game? And it's like, yeah, that's a story that just kind of gets glossed over, this team that was nowhere and really went back to, you know, all due respect, not being a prominent team, was the center of basketball for, you know, just a brief moment in time because of Larry Bird.
You're absolutely right. And I that was a realization that I too made very early on, you know, because we've always done the Bird Magic thing, we lose this entire underdog story. And listen, you know, we talked about St. Patrick's Day. We're also in the thick of March Madness here. This is one of the great March Madness stories of all time. Not Bird Magic. Indiana State is one of the great March Madness stories of all time. And, you know, if a couple plays go differently in that final game, we would have been telling this story for years. You know, it became clear to me early in my reporting, when this was just a little seedling of an idea, that, you know, that this still was a great story, even though the outcome is maybe not what sports fans might want. There's a little bit of Rocky Balboa in this Indiana State team. They might lose that final game, but they're going to win the room. They're going to win the fans. They're going to win the moment. And, you know, it was even apparent in real time. I mean, in the days before that championship game, so the Final Four is set. It's late March. We're in that little window where they're about to play those games. The executives at NBC, which was the broadcast network for the Final Four and the NCAA tournament in the 1970s, they weren't talking about Bird Magic. They were talking about Indiana State. And they said out loud, like the Thursday before the Final Four starts, if Indiana State is in the finals on Monday night, we will go over the top. We will set essentially a television viewership record. It was about that underdog story. It was about Larry Bird, who was, you know, at the time, just objectively a far better player than Magic Johnson. We could have a robust debate. A classic late night sports bar debate about who's the better player all time. Is it Bird? Is it Magic? That's a fun and interesting conversation. But as a college player, it's not close. You know, Magic was averaging 11 points a game in 1979, 11 points. He had no outside shot almost at all. That would come later. Bird's averaging almost 30 points a game, and he's doing it for the third year in a row. And in the AP Player of the Year voting that spring, the voters recognize it. You know, Magic Johnson gets 9 votes. Sidney Moncrief, future All-Star with the Milwaukee Bucks, he's going to get 17 votes for Player of the Year. Larry Bird gets 328 votes. It's a blowout.
Yeah, I think if we've always said if Bird and Magic had been abducted by aliens at some point in 1986 or 1987, the trajectories and the legacies of their careers would probably be different compared to each other. Magic doesn't start winning MVPs until Bird is sort of almost on the back nine of his career. Bird almost falls off a cliff, back injuries, that type of thing. And Magic, you know, was still going strong, you know, in 91. If he hadn't been diagnosed with HIV, he probably would have played a couple more years at a top level. And so I think that people don't really realize how dominant Bird was starting in college and then going into the early years with the Celtics. He didn't have a Kareem to, you know, to carry the load. It was Bird's team from the minute he got there. I want to take a step back, though, because one of the things that's always been interesting to me is just how improbable this whole story was. And I guess maybe I'd kind of pose it to you in the form of maybe a somewhat difficult question. How close was Larry Bird to just never, you know, how close were we to never knowing who Larry Bird was?
I think very close, far closer than most people realize. You know, sports fans, Celtics fans are going to know the general sketch of this story. You know, that Bird graduates from high school in Springs Valley High School, French Lick, Indiana. He's going to get a scholarship offer to play for Bobby Knight at Indiana, in Bloomington. You know, one of the great coaches in America. And he's only going to last 3 weeks there. For reasons we maybe will talk about here today, certainly that are documented in the book with new reporting. 3 weeks, and he drops out, quits, hitchhikes home to French Lick. At that point, he enrolls in vocational school, not a JUCO program, not a community college, voc school. He briefly plays on the basketball team there. There's 200 students at this school in West Baden Springs, Indiana, just north of French Lick, right where Larry Bird has grown up. He will only make it about 3 weeks there, and then he will drop out again. He will quit again. He will get a job for the city street department where, among other duties, he is collecting trash. Larry Bird is that winter. And in that winter of his discontents, his family is, you know, really struggling. His father is unraveling. Tragedy is at the doorstep of the Birdhouse. By March, April 1975, Larry Bird is telling his mother he's not returning to college. He's not going back. Larry, by the way, is a man who then and now does what he says he's going to do. That he's incredibly consistent about that over the course of his life. He is not going back to college, he says. He's telling his mother to run off anyone who comes looking for him. And by the way, no one is looking for him, really. I mean, I scoured the newspapers in the spring of 75. There is not one story, not one, about whither Larry Bird, where is Larry Bird. No one cares. No one cares. This was a guy who was an honorable mention All-State as a senior in high school. He was not first team. He was not second team. According to voters in Indiana, there were 15 players better than Larry Bird. So, you know, he's gone home from Indiana. He's off the map. And, you know, were it not for a man named Bill Hodges, a sort of down on his luck assistant coach at Indiana State, who does go looking for Bird in the spring of 75, I do think we maybe never know Bird's name.
And to me, it's interesting because, you know, obviously Celtics fans and sports historians and probably people from Indiana aside, when Larry Bird's early life, you know, up until high school or up until college, rather, is mentioned, it's really this broad stroke and you fill in a lot of, you're invited to conjure up like the wooden backboard on a barn and this like idyllic pastoral life in small town Indiana, and, you know, hometown boy makes good in the big city. And really, that there's no truth to any of that. He did not have this tranquil, you know, growing up and, you know, obviously his father's suicide and things like that. Like, his backstory that almost gets glossed over is so much more interesting than the fairy tale that people want to point us to.
Yeah, it's a lot more interesting, and it's a lot darker. You know, it's a lot darker. You know, I don't think you can underestimate how dark that fall, winter, and spring was in 74, 75. you know, Larry has just turned 18 at that point. He, enrolls at Indiana in Bloomington with Bobby Knight. He's still 17 years old, which would, by the way, never happen today. Mm-hmm. Show me a college star who enrolls even at 18. I mean, you're 19 or 20. As a freshman these days. Bird is 17 years old when his father, takes his own life. Bird has just turned 18. He's a kid. These days we would have a word for what happens to Larry's father, what happens to the Bird family. This is a trauma. It's a trauma. There's no other way to say it. It's a horrible thing. And, in 2026, even in a rural community, an 18-year-old boy would have, a support system around him, caregivers, therapists, etc. That doesn't exist in rural Indiana in the 1970s. Bird really has to shoulder this alone. It is an incredibly dark time. And I do believe Bird when he said it. That he wasn't going back to college. I do believe it. I've learned one thing over the last 2 years in researching this book. Larry is remarkably consistent. If he says something, he does it. If he says he's not going to do something, he's not going to do it. I take him at his word. And it is Bill Hodges who makes that connection. And it is a connection. We're not even talking about basketball anymore. Bill Hodges is this down on his luck, journeyman assistant coach at Indiana State in the spring of 75. He's on his third job in 3 years. He's gone from Tennessee Tech to Armstrong State to Indiana State. I mean, right? Not the trajectory you're looking for. He only gets the job at Indiana State, Bill Hodges does, because he knows Indiana. He's from rural Indiana. He knows how to recruit that state. Indiana State wasn't going to be recruiting nationally. This is a school that's teetering on the edge of Division II. Can't even fill its gym, is being outdrawn, by high school teams in Western Indiana. The head coach at Indiana State needed someone who could recruit Indiana. He hires Bill Hodges. Hodges knows what it's like to grow up poor, knows what it's like to bale hay. Has seen Bird on two occasions when Bird was in high school, and believes he's someone worth finding if they can, and that really is where it starts.
And I think you talk in the book about how initially it's Hodges and another assistant coach, Stan Evans, who recruit him, and it becomes clear that Evans does not know how to recruit somebody like Bird. You need a special approach that Hodges kind of maybe was uniquely qualified to present.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fascinating, partnership there. And I put that in air quotes. Stan Evans and Bill Hodges, both newly hired, do know each other from a brief overlap at Tennessee Tech. They're totally different people. Stan Evans is an X's and O's strategy guy from Cincinnati, likes to wear pressed slacks, really is almost the antithesis of Bill Hodges and the antithesis of Larry Bird. Based on my reporting and in particular Bill Hodges' memory, all of that comes out, in that first meeting with Larry, when Bill does find him in French Lick. As Bill will say, he wants to get out of there quickly so that, Stan Evans doesn't, burn the bridges with Larry Bird. And from that point forward, Stan Evans isn't going back recruiting Larry. It's Bill Hodges. He's going alone. These two guys are, similar, and not just because they're from rural Indiana. Bill Hodges is incredibly stubborn. Larry Bird is incredibly stubborn. They're cut from the same cloth. They do connect. And, when Bird decides to come back to college and enroll at Indiana State, You know, Bill then does for Larry things that Bobby Knight never did. You know, notably, Bill Hodges recruits to join Larry, a former teammate of his from Springs Valley High School. You know, so Larry is comfortable. He puts them up together. They're roomies. These two guys who are friends from French Lick. They briefly live in Bill Hodges' basement, you know, paying Bill Hodges rent to cover their NCAA bases. Bill then gets Larry a job with, like, the richest man in Terre Haute, you know, putting money in Larry's pocket. You know, all of these things, you know, make Larry comfortable, create almost like a safe place for him. And it's going to be a hard year because, you know, unlike today, a player who changes schools in 1975 has to pay a price for that poor decision. Mm-hmm. You know, has to sit out a year, lose a year. And that's a real hard year that Larry is staring down the barrel of because, you know, he finds solace on the basketball court. And in that one year, he cannot play. And so, you know, Bill Hodges really does need to build that safe place around Larry just to keep him there.
I think maybe my favorite story, at least from this part of the book, is when they're talking about somebody else, and I don't remember who exactly it was, but it was somebody else who was from that French Lick area. And Bird says, oh, you know, here, that's a guy who, you know, had he stuck around and he stayed in school, could have been great and everybody would have known him. And Hodges says something along the lines of, Larry, they're going to say the same thing about you one day if you don't start playing again.
I love that scene. It's in the first meeting. Bill Hodges and Stan Evans have driven down there, driven the streets of French Lick and West Baden looking for Larry, found him, and then, you know, managed to get a meeting in Larry's grandmother's house. And yeah, you're right. You know, Larry does say, you know, if you've come all this way, you know, don't talk to me because I'm not going to college, but maybe you should check out my pal Kevin Carnes. Who, by the way, was a maintenance man at the hotel on State Road 56 by then. And as Larry says, you know, if he'd gone to college, people would know Kevin Carnes. And that's when, you know, Bill Hodges delivers that line. You know, Larry, someday they're going to say the same thing about you. And it's classic Bill Hodges. You know, Bill Hodges is still alive. He's in his early 80s. You know, he still has that sort of straight talk, right to the heart of the matter approach. You know, it was probably drilled in him and ingrained in him from his days in rural Indiana, you know, in the post-war years, hard years, you know, I do believe that line very likely gets Larry's attention. Bill Hodges, unlike other recruiters, isn't slick, isn't telling Larry the things he want to hear, things he wants to hear, isn't delivering him the same lines that he said in the last house on his last visit. He's talking to Larry, and I do believe Larry recognizes that.
In just the few minutes we have left here, I guess, you know, to me, the whole story is interesting, but the story of Bird getting there and how he got there and, you know, the false starts in Indiana and then, you know, going home for a year and all the stuff with his family is maybe sort of the most compelling part of the whole book. But just sort of give us sort of what does it mean for him at Indiana State? It's still, I think, the only time they've ever made it that far or even close to that far in NCAA tournament. What is the legacy of Larry Bird at Indiana State?
It's enormous. You can't underestimate how big it is. I mean, I'll give you a number that tries to capture it that I think will blow people's minds. You know, I wanted to know, I mean, as a journalist, as a historian, what is Larry's value to Terre Haute, Indiana, some 50 years on? You know, worked with tourism officials in the city to try to put a number on that. Larry Bird in 2026, 50 years almost since he last picked up a basketball in Terre Haute, is still worth at least, I'm probably underestimating it, at least $7 million to the local economy of Terre Haute every year.
Wow.
There's a statue outside the arena where Larry played, where thousands of visitors will take a photo every season. There is a museum downtown on Wabash Avenue dedicated to Larry Bird that gets thousands of visitors every year. Outside that museum, there's a 33-foot-tall rendering of Larry Bird's first Sports Illustrated cover, an enormous and frankly beautiful mural right there downtown that, again, thousands of people will take pictures of, you know, in any given year. You know, it's not going to be replicated. We don't know what's going to happen in this year's NCAA tournament. Whatever happens, I assure you, there will not be statues built. There will not be 33-foot murals. There will not be a player 4.5 decades from now who is worth $7 million to the local economy of whatever town he has come from. That era is gone. And I think the other thing that folks just probably don't know is that we've, you know, in our efforts to try to, you know, capture this story and boil it down to Bird magic, we have simplified the story to the point of almost being wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, it really was a team that captures the imagination of America. That Indiana State team, even with Larry Bird as an All-American in the fall of 1978, is not ranked in any preseason polls, is not predicted to do anything. Stan Evans, the coach we mentioned before, quits the team 4 days before practices begin because there's been a coaching shakeup. Bill Hodges has taken over, and Evans isn't going to stick around to work on this team because this team's going nowhere. And then out of nowhere, this Larry Bird Cinderella team, you know, puts together one of the most unlikely seasons in the history of professional sports. You know, it is that team story from this little town in Indiana that is capturing the American imagination. And, you know, again, regardless of what happens this in the next few weeks in the NCAA tournament, I just think it's unlikely to be matched.
Yeah, we've obviously, for time's sake, mostly focused on, you know, Bird and the overall top level, but you do a really, you know, in-depth look at the team. It's not just the story of Larry Bird in 1979. It's, you know, obviously his upbringing and getting him to that point, and then the whole team that, you know, that season and that year. And also, I just want to say what you just said, simplifying the story to the point of almost being wrong, is something that I'm probably going to steal and use, because we talk a lot on this podcast about, you know, things that get, but with the example we always use is Ty Cobb, which is like, the story, any nuance to the story has gotten washed out in the service of what people, whatever point people are trying to make. So I think what you just said is, you know, is very apt for this and for a lot of other things that I'll be using it for. So.
I love it. Steal it. Steal away.
Yeah, no, we definitely will.
I mean, I think it's true. It happens. It happens in history. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It happens in history. I think it especially happens in sports. You know, we just like to boil it down to some basic memorable thing, you know, and then we call it, you know. And again, when you do it that way with this story in particular, you just lose so much. I mean, this is, to me, this book, Heartland, this story, it's like an underdog story wrapped within an underdog story. You mm-hmm. know, it's like layers and layers of miracles that lead to this this moment in time that is so big. This moment, it picks them all up. It picks them all up, and we know what's going to happen to Bird. We know what's going to happen to Magic. We know what happens with March Madness. We know what happens with the NBA. But this moment is so big, it picks them all up. Everybody who's around Bird in that moment. And it propels them forward to places they don't go or never get to were it not for this moment. It's like a tide mm-hmm. that collects them and moves them to a different place. And that, to me, is just so incredibly powerful. I agree with what you said before, Dan. I love the early arc of this story where it feels like Larry Bird's never escaping French Lick, where Larry Bird's never going to become Larry Bird, where it takes a miracle just to get him to Terre Haute. I love that. But I also love that sort of that last section of the book, you know, where we see how one moment in time, like ripples, through the decades, changing everything. I just think that's incredibly compelling and makes it more than just a sports story. I do think it's just a really powerful human narrative.
And I think you definitely give us a very strong sense of time and place, both, you know, an idea of what Terre Haute and French Lick were like in the 1970s and early 1980s, but also, you know, really what it was, what the Final Four was like in those days, kind of very much a sense of, even though it's not that long ago and it's, you know, I guess not quite in my lifetime, but very close to being in my lifetime, just about sort of how different so many different things were. And so I just, Keith, I want to thank you so much for joining us, for letting us talk to you here about the book, and for really for writing this, because it's, you know, it's a sort of an untold story of an all-time great. And when you think about how many sporting legends, you know, Jordan, Ruth, you know, I see a book, you know, about Ali, on your shelf there. How many of these guys have had their stories told, you know, numerous times, excellently told, but told numerous times. This is an aspect of the Bird story that really there was a gap in, and we really appreciate you filling it and appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it tonight.
Oh my gosh, my pleasure. And I hope your father enjoys the book.
He will. He will. All right. Well, the book is Heartland, A Forgotten Place, An Impossible Dream, and The Miracle of Larry Bird. It is available now. And our guest has been the author, Keith O'Brien. Keith, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. It was my pleasure.
Well, we will, we want to thank you all for listening as always, and we will be back. Andrew and I will be back with you soon. But until then, I'm Dan Newman.
I'm Andrew Newman. Goodbye, old sports.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude. And I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.